Here we go.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Thanks for being here this morning. I know many of you, I don't know others. I'm Ari Werthmann, I'm the Director of College Counseling, and welcome to the pre-beginning of your students' college search. This is a really exciting time for all of us. We're working with seniors right now, and they're sort of in the throes of the process, but we're just beginning to look ahead to working with juniors. How many of you have had an older student go through this process before, either here or elsewhere? And how many of you are first-timers? Oh, wow.
Congratulations.
We promise you this is a fun process. I can't promise you there won't be some bumps, but it is a really great opportunity for your students, obviously not only to begin to explore their futures, but to make one of their first really big decisions. One of the parts of the process I was telling one of you yesterday who I ran into, one of the parts of the process that I particularly love is students actually beginning to learn how to prioritize what's really important to them and what they want in the next phase of their education. You know, it's very common that students go into the process thinking they're going to find that absolute perfect college that's out there for them, or that perfect fit, for lack of a better phrase. And as they begin to go through the process, they realize there's no such thing. And sometimes that emerges in conversations such as, you know, I really don't like hot weather. I'm like, oh, okay, well, great. Like, let's talk about schools that you're really interested in. I really want to go to University of Southern California. And then all of a sudden they realize, wait a minute, the conundrum there of that's in a hot climate, but I don't want hot weather, but there are so many other things about it I really, really like. You know, I've had students over the past, and sometimes it's really arbitrary, and you can't always explain it. My very first year in college counseling at my former independent school in South Florida, I had a young man who was actually an international student, and he wasn't a boarder, but his family had come to the States for him to attend high school, and he was convinced he had to go to any college or university that had the name Washington in it. So his college list was WashU, George Washington University, Mary Washington University, and like even his parents were like, what is this? So it's not always what you expect, and it's not always what they expect either. But it is a really great opportunity for them to get to sort of sift out what is important to them, what their future looks like, and to really think about what's beyond Lakeside. A few things before we move into actual questions and answers in the actual program itself. First of all, hopefully in the emails you've seen, we're trying something new this year, and that is we're recording all the coffee talks, hence this little thing that's in front of the three of us, which is why we're behind this table so the microphone can pick up all three of us. That is also why we will repeat every question that's asked, not necessarily because we couldn't hear you, but so the microphone can hear you. Or actually what will probably happen is I'll forget to repeat the question and Tiffany or Sam will remind me to repeat the question. So hopefully this will work, and obviously not only for families that couldn't be here, if there's a part of the program you wanted to go back to in terms of one of our responses at some point, the audio file will be posted on the Parents and Guardians section of the Lakeside website. And if you scroll down, hopefully some of you have seen that there are some college counseling resources. If you expand that section, the file will be there for you to listen to. Some of you who have gone through the process before here at Lakeside know our office, but many of you I can see are new, and so as I said, I'm Ari Werthmann, I'm the director. Sitting on my right is Tiffany Fujioka, who's our senior associate director, who joined us 3.5 years ago after many years of undergraduate admissions work at the University of Pennsylvania, and then having done some college counseling work at the George School in Pennsylvania. And then in 2011, she followed her husband out here, who works for Amazon. Tiffany apparently is the fun one in our office. According to my former advisees, the class of 2016, I had a cohort of advisees that graduated, and they were kind enough to tell me, you know, all the students talk about the different reputations of the college counselors. I was like, do tell. So Tiffany is the fun one. She laughs really loudly, and she laughs a lot. And sometimes when they're having a fun conversation, you'll even see Tiffany's feet up on a chair or a desk. And then to my left is Sam Freesha, who's our assistant director of college counseling. Sam also joined us 3 years ago after having worked in undergraduate admissions at Colby College in Maine. And before that, having done some work in undergraduate admissions at Colgate University, his undergraduate alma mater. So Sam and our office, apparently, according to my former advisees, is the one that knows everything. He knows everything about admissions. Some students, I don't know if they do anymore, but in that class, he got his last name is Freesha. Students called him the Freesh. Not with us this morning. Many of you will know Catherine Jacobson. Catherine's a longtime member of the Lakeside community, and she's been doing college counseling for 25 years, which she started doing when she was 5. Please, if you see her, promise me that you will tell her that I did put that annotation in there. And she's wonderful. And according to my former advisors, she's like our mother. Catherine's really caring, and she makes you come in, and she's like, no, I'm not going to let anything bad happen to you. No, you're not applying to all these REACH schools. Mark Cranwinkle is, some of your students will know him. Mark is the head of our languages department and has taught French for many years, and he's also been part of the college counseling team for the past decade. According to our students, Mark is like their father. Mark has 3 kids who have gone through the college process of his own. He has his youngest daughter in high school right now. And then there's me, and when I asked them, what about me? And they were like, oh, you respond to emails really fast. it was like just what I always wanted my legacy in life to be. So that is who we are, and we're really excited to work with you and your students. What will happen in December, and hopefully all of you have gotten those dates before. We sent them out in June, and then we sent them out again as a reminder in the fall, and I have them printed on here. In December, right around the same time that we do the intro programs for you, we'll do intro programs during the day for your students. The intro programs that you see here, they're the exact same program, just replicated at 3 different times in 3 different locations for your convenience. So we realize that there's no one time or date that, you know, there's always someone where there's a conflict, but we hope that between these 3, you can find one that works best for your schedule and join us. And shortly after that, right after they return from their winter break, they'll be assigned a college counselor, one of us, although we all work together as a team. We have weekly team meetings, and we discuss students' college lists, and we ask for advice about new ideas and thoughts that maybe haven't crossed our minds. And so, yes, both you and your student have one point person, for lack of a better phrase. But however, in the end, they sort of have the expertise of all of us. One of the reasons a few of you I know have asked, and just, I think it might be a question I'm not sure if it's on here, actually. I guess not. But in our FAQs that we sent out last June, that we don't assign college counselors sooner, there are a few different reasons. Number one, the biggest one is it's really hard for us to start building a student's college list until they're midway through junior year, because what their junior grades are, and so we can use their semester marks as estimators of what those will be, what their junior coursework is, what it's looking like they're going to take as a senior, and also just who they are changes a lot over upper school. So but, you know, sometimes, and this is not a bad thing if some of you have taken your kids to visit colleges because it gives them perspective, but often what they thought they liked as a sophomore, they really come to realize as a second semester junior or first semester senior wasn't at all what they thought. So it's a combination of those things that we start midway through the junior year, but we always, and I see some familiar faces from prior coffee talks, we do want to get information to you sooner and to help you figure out how you can best support your students as you're going through the process. So you do have some of those FAQs in front of you, and again, hopefully you've seen them before, and in a few minutes when we open it to questions and answers, we're certainly happy to elaborate on any of those. The question we probably get the most, though, as students begin to think about what they can be doing now to sort of prepare for the college process, is the very last question on there it's on the front side, but the very last question about are there new activities they should be joining? And the simple answer to that really is no. And the reason is simply because, and I know it's sort of a oversimplified, hokey response, but we'll go into a little bit more detail. The answer to that is because it really is about quality and not quantity. And so to sort of give you a sense of what that means and how that actually plays out in the college process, if you flip over to the backside of your sheet, what you're seeing is a blurb I took from a mock common application that I designed. And what you're looking at is the activities section. Students can enter that top area. I've just happened to enter 4. I really rushed through it pretty quickly, so I wouldn't say it's my best writing, or I wouldn't even necessarily say that I always tell my students they should begin each description with a verb. But what I wanted to see is, number one, they can enter a maximum of 10 activities. And 10 activities includes anything they've done over the summers, anything they've done over the school years, anything they've done over breaks, any jobs they've held, any hobbies they really want to convey. So basically, basically most of our students who have lots of different interests between hobbies and summer activities and school year activities and break activities, most of our students are actually making choices about what they're going to include and not include in the application. And moreover, what you can also see here too, if you look at the very first activity, you'll notice the description I wrote cuts off, which I did purposefully, because that is literally, if you look at where it starts month-long service learning trip to Morocco, that is literally the exact amount of space they get to describe every activity. And so when we say no, they don't need to add new activities, we do it because we want students and families to have the perspective that it really is not about the laundry list of activities. And again, you can see here that there really is a max. And so if your student has the capacity to design a resume that's longer than any of ours, and some of our students can, the reality is that resume is not going to be conveyed in the application. They're really going to be thinking about what are the things that are most important to me, what are the things I've been most committed to. And then down below on the common application, what you're looking at are the seven different essay prompts, and they get to choose one, and it's a maximum of 650 words. So really, in the main part of the application, what you're getting is they have very limited, they're essentially listing their extracurricular activities. They're not really going into any detail as to what they are or what the meaning of them was behind each one of them. And then they get this sort of one longer space, which is a maximum of 650 words. That's about 3/4 of a page single-spaced, to actually tell them something else about themselves in their own voice. So the application process is really one not only about quality. I always describe it to some students as their first, in certain respects, it's their first lesson in actually applying for a job. In that when you're actually thinking about, like, what are the things about me that I've done that are actually a really good match for this institution? What are the things about me that are actually going to be appealing to this institution? We joke with them, but we are serious, and they laugh, but sometimes they forget it. It's not their autobiography. Sometimes they think it is, but it's really not. And sometimes they'll come in panic. There's no room in the application for me to tell them that I used to do ballet, and I did ballet all the way through eighth grade, but then I stopped. And the answer is just that they're actually just not going to care. So we really want them to be thinking about just sort of what is unique about them and what is special about them. I told one student the other day, this is my sort of standard line, who was thinking about what she was going to write in her essay, that when I applied for this job at Lakeside 6 years ago, you know, I talked a lot in my cover letter and in my resume about what I'd done in college counseling and what I'd done in college admissions. And now that I'm here, Mr. No is very happy to talk about because he likes to run too. We talk about running all the time. We talk about politics. We both really like politics. He didn't care about my interest in politics or running when I was applying for this job. And so same thing for the students when they're applying to college. There are things that make them a good fit, and there are sometimes things that are important to them and maybe really interesting about them that aren't necessarily the right things for their application. And so it's really getting to think a little bit holistically about what their place is in the world and how the outside world is going to evaluate them and make choices about their accomplishments and their interests. But it is a fun process. As I said, there are some bumps in it. When I say fun, I don't mean it's absent of stress or responsibility. And for some students, it can be bumpier or more stressful than others. But I think in the end, one of the things we always emphasize to students and families is it actually is in their control how stressful they want it to be and how bumpy they want it to be. And so we work with them on that. And we are happy to sort of, try to make the process as least stressful as it can be. So at this point, we would love to hear what you're wondering about and what things, as you look ahead to the college process, what questions you have, what facets of the process or the admissions landscape you would like to hear more about. Yes. Okay. I'll repeat the question and I'll let them know. So the question essentially is for potential athletes, especially those that might be recruited, how does our office work with them? Because there is an athletic recruiting process that in some ways goes hand in hand with the general college process, and other ways is its own beast, for lack of a better phrase. And so we will talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So first thing that I should say is for any of you that students are considering an athletic recruiting process, you absolutely should check out our athletic recruiting document on the website. We've summed up a lot of the frequently asked questions, as well as the timeline, as well as the general process for what your students should be doing to engage in the recruitment process from the start of whenever that might begin for them. But after that starting resource, if the student actually is getting contact from coaches, then it would be appropriate to reach out to our office. We do have a few students every year that maybe think that they're getting heavily recruited, and maybe they're not, and vice versa. So we'd love to, you know, add some clarity to that to actually assist in whatever way we can. Anything to add there?
Yeah, I don't think so. The only thing I guess I would add is that typically the sports that have what we call accelerated timelines, meaning in this very unhealthy, crazy way, but it is what it is, they are essentially coaches are reaching out to students really soon. Lacrosse has an especially accelerated timeline, especially men's, but women's as well. Baseball's is accelerated, tennis is accelerated, volleyball is accelerated. Sports like crew, football, basketball, the sports that didn't name, most of those still follow a standard timeline, meaning that essentially we're starting with us midway through the junior year. That timeline will work hand in hand. But as Sam said, those students are, and especially those being contacted by D1 coaches, that process starts much sooner, at the tippy top of D1, that is. And if they're getting those contacts, don't hesitate to reach out to us. Yes.
Advances in data science that predict the ability of where students are going to be able to get into and what schools are good fits is advanced. So could you talk a little bit about some of the tools and data sets that you use to generate the range of schools that you're going to recommend our students apply to?
Yep. So the question was, with the advance essentially in data science, there are all types of tools now even available to college counselors to help students assess their chances of admission or predict their chances of admission at the institutions that they're applying to. And that can also obviously help us work with students to generate their college lists. And so we'll talk a little bit about some of those R.
So one of the programs that we will be using that you'll get access to in the spring of this year, spring semester, correct?
Naviance December, but yes, Scattergrams in the spring, yes.
Is a program called Naviance. And Naviance contains all the historical data that we have from our students here at Lakeside, all the colleges that they have applied to, and the results of those applications beginning in 2013.
13, 14, no, so we show 3 years of data, so God, I'm bad at math. 14.
Oh, right. So, but we have the data that goes a little bit farther than that, but you will be able to have access to the past, usually 3 years. Some schools might show 5 years, but what we have seen is that the trends and things are changing so quickly that it's really only helpful to look back at the last 3 years. And so we use this a lot in our process. So essentially what happens is that each student will get plotted on a graph that's plotted by GPA as well as SAT score. And we use that a lot to determine the likelihood of admission. So whether we think a school is a likely school where we're very confident they'll be admitted, whether we think it's a target school where they kind of had a 50-50 shot, or whether we think it's an unlikely school. So, and those are, you know, the IBs and that type of institution. So we use that a lot in that process. And there's a ton of just like information out there, you know, in our colleagues' brains, anecdotally, about a lot of these schools and institutions, as well as the places where each of us has worked. So we have a lot of that anecdotal evidence in our heads, and also with access to it. One thing you should know, the college counseling and college admissions world is very small. So we all know a lot of people and use those connections and networks to help inform the advice that we give to students. There's also a lot of really wonderful books out there that we use, especially in the help of generating student lists. And so one of the best ones is The College Finder by Jonathan Antonoff, and that just came out with a new edition this year. It had been like 10 years since the last one. And that book is so wonderful because it lets students kind of browse schools by personality, which is something that's really hard to do in any kind of search engine, right? There's tons of search engines online that students can use, or that we also can use and do use to generate lists for kids. But that one is really nice because it'll say, like, you know, for students who might be really interested in service, or for students who really want to make sure there's a strong debate team, or for students who are on the shyer side, what are some good colleges that fit that kind of personality? So we use a lot of that in our process, but the data certainly is something that's really helpful. We always caution people, like, you're going to see these graphs, and sometimes the data is there, but you don't know all the stories behind it. All it's showing is SAT and GPA, and we know that there's a lot more factors that come into the process, and so we always tell students, you know, use the scattergrams, those graphs, to generate questions to ask us, but not necessarily answers for yourself.
Yep. The question was, do the graphs not take into account the level of classes they took? And correct, the answer is just GPA and SAT or ACT scores. Other questions?
I've got a question about when you start looking at the colleges, when you don't really have a list, what do you advise parents and students to do?
Yep. So the question is, when do students typically start looking at colleges? When is that list generated? So what we do, as I said, we start meeting with the students in January. So a few different things. In the ideal world, but it doesn't always work out this way, so I'll clarify. I'd say in the ideal world, students maybe do some visits over the spring break, perhaps over the summer, maybe even some early fall. That works for some students. It doesn't always work, especially for some of our spring athletes, where they have regattas, they have baseball games. And so what that means is those families might go over the summer, or sometimes, understandably, they want to go over winter break, which makes a lot of sense. And certainly if they want to look east, winter break in some respects is a good time to go, because if they go in February and they like the campus, then that's a good sign. If they go in February and they're like, I can't do this, that's a sign they probably shouldn't be going to the Northeast. But to go back to sort of directly answering your question, so for those students, what will happen if a family lets us know right as soon as they're assigned a college counselor that, hey, we want to do visits over the February break, that's what's really best for us, we immediately start working to generate a college list. And sometimes, just because of the way the timeline works, there are occasions where we maybe haven't even met with your student yet, but you're saying, you know, or your student is saying, we're going, and based on, we have a ton of surveys, there's a survey we're going to have your student fill out for us before January, there's a survey that we're going to ask you to fill out for us, we collect information from teachers, so we have a lot to really at least provide, if you're saying, we're going to go to the East Coast and we want to visit colleges, to be able to suggest, if you're going to go to Boston, these are some places you might look, or if you're going to go to D.C., these are some places you might look. Did that answer your question? Yes.
Differentiate or evaluate the significance of a GPA at Lakeside versus other high schools?
So the question is, do colleges evaluate, let me know if I'm rephrasing your question incorrectly, evaluate the context of Lakeside grades, GPA, in the context of Lakeside, and therefore compare us appropriately to other schools and the caliber of other schools?
That's totally what I meant to say.
Yeah. So to answer that question, I think it is important to remember that nationwide there are an infinite number of grading systems and grading scales, and it's almost impossible to normalize. It's one of the main reasons that we don't send a GPA. We really want the college reps to be analyzing our transcripts, reading in concordance with our rec letters and understanding that academic path for the student. If they choose to recalculate and normalize a GPA scale, then they might do that. But all colleges, or for the most part all colleges, will be assessing the rigor and quality of the high school itself, as well as the curriculum choices for each student. And I'll just like kind of draw from experience, having worked on the admissions side. We had an internal, at Colby, we had an internal high school evaluation system for how we interpreted transcripts from different schools. And there were a small selection of high schools that fell into our top tier category, where regardless of what our academic assessment was, we would always bump that student up one more notch, and Lakeside was one of the schools in that small category. The University of Washington does a different system. I think since about half of the people here will probably have a student apply there, it's good to talk about that. They use what's called the high school differential. What that means is they'll look at the recent data for students from Lakeside that have actually enrolled at the UW, compare their high school GPA, what they have crunched their high school GPA to be, compare that to what they achieved at the end of their freshman year, and see how are our students performing when they actually go to the UW. For most high schools in the state and in the country, they have a negative GPA differential. They expect students' GPA to go down when they enroll at the UW. Lakeside, we have about a plus 0.5 is how they evaluate that. They've seen that our students typically, their GPA goes up about a full half letter grade. So there's a variety of different ways that comes into play, but schools absolutely do take into consideration the academic experience that your students are going through.
Yeah, I actually was just pulling it out because we were at this breakfast last week with UW. So over a five-year period, the average GPA for all UW freshmen is after their freshman year is a 3.12, and the average GPA for Lakesiders at the UW after their freshman year is a 3.54. So our students are doing really well there, and they know that, and we see that in the admission decisions. And I would just piggyback on what Sam said. I had the opportunity last February to sit in for a day at Hamilton College and observe their admission committee, and it was eye-opening for me. It was very similar to what Sam said. They have a 16-point scale for how they evaluate applications, with the max being 16, so that's the goal. There's a maximum of 2 points for high school. Most high schools are zero. There are some that are one. There are about 100 different high schools in the country that they give 2 points to. So, and we're in that last category of 2 points. So our students, before their application has even been opened, start off with 2 points in the Hamilton evaluation system, and then they add points on top of that, with the highest being 16. So they it's almost like they start off ahead in the race. But as I tell the kids, other students can catch up. And so it's not a guarantee that you go to Lakeside and therefore you're going to get in over other students. But they do essentially start ahead of other students, if that makes sense. Yes.
How do you guys place our students with your team, Ari?
Yep. The question was, how do we place students, how do we assign college counselors to each individual student?
So we we go through a pretty, a good comprehensive and fair process. We will meet with our student support team and try to tap into other resources on campus for folks who know the kids better than we do. And so a lot of times they'll have specific recommendations on, I know this kid's personality, I think they'll work really well with Sam, or like, this person needs a lot of, like, you know, structure and keeping them in line, and they'll work better with someone else, and whatever it's going to be. But we try to match personalities with working styles as much as we can, and so that's one thing that we do. A lot of times, if we know the students from another part of campus, so Sam has gone on GSL trips to Thailand, so those kids will typically get assigned to Sam. If we have advisees who are in the junior class, which I don't think we have any of this year, but that would get assigned to an advisor. If you have worked with a counselor with an older sibling, we typically will automatically assign the same counselor unless you guys tell us otherwise. And it does not hurt our feelings at all. A lot of times siblings want just really different experiences. That's all their own. So we completely understand that and are absolutely welcome to that. So please express those things if you have any an interest or concern about that. And we get all of this data together, and we have a big giant spreadsheet, and we try to make sure that we divide things very evenly. We're in the spreadsheet. I'm constantly keeping tally of, how many athletes that we know are likely going to go through the recruiting process? Do each of us have? We divide the class as evenly as possible by ethnic background to make sure that none of us is working with a majority of the students. So I had one of my counselees this year say, "Oh, you work with all the Asian kids." And I was like, "No, that's not true. I have like two more than everybody else, and that doesn't make it like all of them." But so the kids have their own false perceptions out there. But so we try to divide it up very evenly by gender, by ethnic background, by pretty much any kind of measure that we have data on, just to make sure that it's evenly distributed and that we're all working with students throughout the whole class. So nobody gets all the kids at the top, you know, or anything like that. We literally divide GPAs up evenly as well. So we try to make sure that we have a lot of breadth within each of our counseling loads.
Follow up on twins. Do you tend to put them together?
Question is about, in the case of twins, do we put them together?
And that depends. In some cases, yes. Like Ari has worked with a set of triplets in the past.
Yes.
Last year we had a set of twins, and I had one, and Mark had the other. So it really kind of depends on, I think parent input is very, very helpful in this case. So if you think the kids would be better off, especially if they have really different personalities, having different counselors, please let us know. And, you know, we also will, Ari will put out a feeler. Like, if you have a preference, you are more than welcome to express a preference. We cannot guarantee that we can honor all of those, but... if you had a specific request, you have to put that in writing to Ari.
And the requests we really do our best to honor are the ones are in scenarios where the student has, as Tiffy was saying earlier, some prior relationship with a counselor. So like as she was mentioning, all the kids that went with Sam, what was it, two summers ago to GSL Thailand all actually wrote to request, can they please work with Sam? So that was great. And those are ones we really went out of our way to honor. So we can't honor all of them, but those are the ones that 99.9% of the time we make happen.
You kind of give us a little bit of background on how do you help the students to decide that one school or just a few in that process. And I also know that the timing has kind of accelerated to like November 1st.
So the question is, there are more students applying early decision and early action, which I'll define in a second. So how do we help students choose that school and how do we help them get to that point? So I'll define them and then I'll turn it over to Tiffany and Sam and talk a little bit about how we get there. So there are two programs if you're not familiar with them. Early decision is a program through which through which your student applies to a first choice college or a top choice college by, it's usually a deadline of November 1 or November 15th, and they hear usually in mid-December. With early decision, if they are admitted, they are bound to attend. So they can only apply one place early decision, and you, their counselor, and the student, him or herself, signs an agreement saying, we understand that if we're admitted early decision, and if we are applying financial aid and get the financial aid package that we need, we are definitely coming. There is another program, well, there are actually a lot of programs, but we'll just stick with the two basic ones. There's another program called Early Action, which is, it's a similar time frame, meaning the student also applies by November 1 or November 15th, and here is in mid-December. The difference between early decision and early action is that in early action, the student isn't bound to attend. It's simply an earlier deadline. In the case of early decision, and we'll actually, that's a really good question, in the December program, we're going to actually show you some of the data about how this has happened and what this looks like. In the early decision pool at almost any institution, the pools, they're as competitive, meaning a student with lower grades doesn't get in the early pool versus the regular pool, but they're less selective. The pools are smaller. Just quick numbers example, I'm going to look at Tiffany because she worked at Penn, and so I think I do the numbers right. I think in early decision, I think the admit rate was about 1 out of 5, and in regular now it's like under 1 out of 10. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah.
And so, again, it's the same caliber of student, but it's just more selective. So there's a lot more, lack of a phrase, nitpicking that will go on in the regular process to make distinctions between students. So there is an advantage in early decision. Early action really depends on the school. There are some schools that makes no difference whatsoever whether they apply early action or regular action. There are some schools where also there are some distinct advantages to being in the early pool, and depending, and we will keep you and your student informed of what those schools are. And so to your second point, I'll turn it over to Tiffany and Sam to talk a little bit about how we get students from the beginning of the process in January to being ready to decide whether early is for them, and if so, which school.
Sure. So I think it all starts with day one of actually working with them. When your student will get assigned to a college counselor, we call it the first Monday after New Year's, something right around there, they are encouraged to immediately start signing or sending an email to us to actually set up their first college counseling meeting. From that initial meeting, we'll start to get to know them. We'll start to see what they're interested in at that point in time, knowing that it will probably change over the next couple months. But we will start seeing where their general interests are, academic, social, location, you name it, and generate that first list. And that first list will be broad. And the goal is to find things that you like, but also find things that you don't like. So you cast that wider net so you can focus more narrowly throughout the year. So we will be meeting with them regularly throughout the junior spring to see how they're engaging with the search process and starting to identify which ones are starting to resonate a little bit more with them. So it's vital to have a good understanding of the schools, because if you're actually going to make a commitment to one of these institutions to enroll there if admitted, it really has to be the place that you want to call home for 4 years. So it's really tough when a student, you know, in October says, oh, I just found this school, I think I want to apply ED there. And you're like, well, what? You've never even been there and you want to bind yourself there and things like that. So early engagement throughout the junior year with the search process will make your students able come senior fall able to make that transition from college searching to college applying and really make an accurate decision for them that feels right. And I always say that, you know, I think our process, you know, going back to the data question, you know, we do know a lot of the other end of things, and we do have a strategic angle, but we do want our students' heart to drive their search, but there needs to be an intersection point. One of the main factors of fit is admissibility. And we will be pretty open and honest with you guys, your students, so they don't just create top-heavy lists that aren't going to actually present options to them. So it's a balancing game, balancing act.
Yeah, I think when you think about early decision, I think there's two schools of thought. And one of them is, you know, you put that first choice card into your dream school. You're like, I don't care what the odds are of me getting in. This is my first place. I love this place. That's where I want to apply. And when I worked in admissions, like, that was my idealistic way of how people thought about early decision. I would stand up in front of a room and say, early decision is a commitment. It is not a strategy. It's a commitment. And so you need to take it seriously. And now, on the college counseling side, I realize, oh, no, early decision, it's a commitment, but it absolutely is a strategy. And I think the other school of thought about it is that you're not necessarily applying to the schools that is your tippy top choice. Maybe that one is going to be too far of a reach, and we talk about the opportunity cost of reaching too high, and how doing that you might lose opportunities to get into a school that is maybe like your very close second choice school. But that you'd have a lot bigger advantage if that early decision card is used there. So we talk with students about this and strategically, and you know, does ED have an advantage here versus somewhere else, and what the best school to sort of put that card into would be. So we do talk very strategically with them. Ultimately, it's their decision whether to follow their heart or to kind of be tempted by the strategy. And either way, it's fine. We're going to support them no matter what. But it's good to know that there's sort of two different ways of thinking about it, because you might be hearing two different things.
And I would say, just to wrap it up, our goal and the way we structure our program and the process, and I promise you're next, is that our goal is for everyone to be at a point by right around the very beginning of October, where we can have a conversation with them. Is early decision and or early action for you, and if so, which schools? So in the spring, that will happen a little bit differently for every student. Some students come into our office in January, and they're like, here's the list of 30 schools I researched, and I'm so excited, and oh my God, like I'm going on visits, and we're like, this is awesome. And then we have other students that come in, and they're like, I am so scared. I don't know how to research a college. I don't, like, I'm so afraid. And that process might start with that being like, great, baby steps. Like we talk a little bit, but like, here are five schools. Like, you know, we talk a little bit about how to research those. They come back to the next meeting. We talk about those. We give them a few more. So for some students, they're ready to throw themselves into the process on January 1, and others really need to gradually enter the process on their own terms. But we really, I think, get everyone, basically when they come back in the fall, everyone's on slightly different pages, but those the gradations of that of what page you're on are a lot smaller than what they were in the spring, where I think everyone needs sort of a slightly adjusted timeline to sort of account for where they are emotionally. Good question. How do we generate a list in January if they haven't taken their SAT or ACT yet?
So we will use one main thing that we use is a survey that we give to them, and that asks a lot about their preferences, or what they think their preferences are, at least, with regards to things like size, location, in terms of part of the country, or rural versus urban or suburban. We ask if they have a desire to be in a religious community, if, you know, performing arts is important, if they care about Greek life, if they want school spirit. So we try to give them a lot of different factors to evaluate to get a sense of what type of school community they're looking for. And then when we do not have any official testing, which for most students we don't have until later in the spring, we use their PSAT scores as sort of the baseline. So,
yeah. Or the mock ACT,
right,
if your students join us, which is December 9th, I think. And you'll get shortly after November 1, you'll get an email from our office about how to register for that. It's on campus. It's a free opportunity.
And I would just really like to make a plug for doing that.
Yes.
The mock ACT. Don't just do the PSAT. Yeah. Please also encourage your kids or just sign them up to do the mock ACT.
If there's a conflict, because I usually, no matter how we structure it, there's usually some type of sports conflict that occurs with the mock ACT. If there is a conflict, Apparuth Tutoring, which is the company that administers the mock ACT, usually has all they're really doing is coming to our campus and doing it for our students. They usually have other mock opportunities around Seattle, so they can do it another day. But as Tiffany was saying, it's a really great thing. What actually is really helpful in early January, even without any official testing results, is if they come in and they're sort of like, I've done the PSAT, which is essentially a practice SAT, and I've done the mock ACT, and I sort of know the ACT works better for me. Because the first thing we do at the meeting is generate a testing plan to get them through the rest of the spring. And if they've gotten to that point, that actually, they're in a really good place. If they're not starting with, well, I don't know what the SAT is and ACT is, if they're starting with, I know the ACT is for me, it makes their testing plan a lot smoother and a lot less cumbersome.
So I have a specific question, but I think it has a general application.
Sure.
So I have a child doing semester school next semester. And so you don't recommend the SATs until later, that she's already registered for December because she knows she's going to be away. How many SATs or ACTs do you recommend for the kids? And if she takes it in December and still wants to take it in the spring and next fall, is there damage done by taking it three times?
That's a really good question. So we're talking, in this case, and actually I'm glad you asked it, students studying away, whether it's for a semester or for a year, each of the away programs we have, whether it's study school year abroad, Seagull, Mountain School, have different, offer students different testing opportunities on slightly different timelines. And so if a student, some of them do encourage December testing. And so if they test in December and they want to retest, is that okay? How many times can they retest? Could they retest a second time in the spring and even a third time perhaps in the fall? Sorry.
Technically they can... Technically, they can sign up for any sitting that is available to them. We would strongly advise doing nothing of that kind. There is definitely a thing called testing burnout. We've seen, and nationally you see, that usually after the third sitting of an exam, you're not going up from there. First to second, second to third, often most often actually does see some nice increases. We've also seen a trend over the last 2 years where our senior fall testing or August or September sittings have produced some actually especially incredible increases. So that's been a trend as well. I think it's a combination of a lower stress environment having just had the summer off and maybe some extra prep work in addition to maybe them already having a baseline score so then it's not all the pressure on that one sitting. So definitely we'd love to limit it to 3, but we can't actually put a hard limit on it. Many students, I'd say the majority of students will test more than once, but 2 or 3 is the general average and what we would advise.
And just a note for those of you that have students that will be studying away, if they're gone, what we do, they go through the entire process with us. So if they are studying away second semester, we essentially, they'll come to the intro programs while they're here first semester. And then second semester, we'll do all the same meetings we do with everyone else except via Skype. And certainly for the second semester programs, you as parents and guardians, we hope you'll join us even though your student is away. If your student is away right now, the intro programs we do for the juniors right after Thanksgiving, we will do a video for those students so they can get that same information and then come back second semester and feel like they're at the same starting point as their classmates. And if they're gone for the entire year, they'll have the video and we'll Skype with them in the spring. Yes. Oh. Yes. That's a good question, and I'm going to give you an. Oh, I'm sorry. The question is, what is the testing breakdown SAT versus ACT among Lakesiders, and how has that changed over the years? So I'm going to give you an anecdotal answer, and every time I'm asked this question, I'm like, yes, I need to calculate it, and then I forget to calculate it. But to give you a sense, so when I arrived in 2013, the default was the SAT. We had very students typically took the ACT if they were struggling with the SAT. We are now at a point where I'd say at least half of our students have experienced both in some sense, if not more than that. I would say we're pretty close to half and half in terms of who's doing what, and we have a lot more students who have. Taken the ACT who then never take the SAT. And in fact, one of the reasons for your reference, and I know Bernie has talked about this publicly, we've seen a decline in our number of National Merit semifinalists, which doesn't bother me is so much as because with a lot of students realizing earlier on after the mock, some of your students might have taken the mock ACT as sophomores. So we have students that realize after that experience that they were like, the ACT is for me, not the SAT. And so any prep work they might have thought about doing over the summer went to the ACT. We have a lot of high ACT scorers who probably would have been high SAT scorers, but they're just not taking they're not taking the PSAT as seriously as they once did. And Tiffany has pulled up the data
from this past year's
from last year's class.
And so in last year's class, 52% of the students took the SAT at least once, and 75% took the ACT at least once. So that's certainly a shift.
And that's actually a national trend that the ACT has now outpaced the SAT. And so a lot of times you get a question, you know, do colleges prefer one or the other? And they don't. And in fact, if you talk, Lisa Nelson from our office is in here, but the coastal cities and states are typically have been more dominated by the SAT. And for those of us that grew up in those regions, you probably grew up with the SAT as I did. The Midwest and the Rocky Mountain states, and many of those communities, the ACT always dominated. So if you talk to Lisa Nelson, she didn't even know what the SAT was until she joined the Lakeside community, but she only knew what ACT was. Yes. Question is, do we ever recommend students taking both?
I think sometimes it ends up being that way. A lot of times, you know, students, I think they're conditioned or more used to the type of questioning and pacing that's on the PSAT. And so I found that students often don't do as well on the mock ACT because they're not used to that kind of format and the pacing is quite fast. And so sometimes the students will not do as well on the mock ACT and just assume like, because my score wasn't better, therefore the SAT is the better one for me. Even though they might have thought the questions were being asked more directly, and that might have felt a little bit friendlier to them. And so they'll go ahead and they'll take the SAT, and maybe they'll try it a couple of times and just don't feel like they're really reaching their potential. And a lot of times, and I've had that with at least, I'd say, 5 students in the senior class. And I'm, why don't you try the ACT? And they do, and all of those kids have done better on the first ACT over both of their SAT scores, even though they did prep also for the SAT. And so I think students need to be a little bit flexible in their thinking. A lot of times they get very rigidly stuck on, well, this score was better, therefore that's definitely the best test for me. But there's a lot of other things to consider about the two tests. And so it certainly does happen. And sometimes the kids come out of those mock tests and they're like, I just don't really know. They both kind of seemed fine. And then in that case, and sometimes, yeah, I do have them sit for both tests. And there's certainly time for that in the testing calendar to be able to do that. So for some kids, it you know, that will absolutely happen. For others, they try one, they do great, and they're done. So,
yes.
From the college application perspective, looking at AP versus SAT2, it seems like a lot of the schools require 2 SAT2s. But if you're looking at where doing most of them in one area or the other, how do colleges?
So the question is, number one, a two-prong, so correct me if I'm wrong, AP versus SAT subject test, where do they both fit into the process? And secondly, for students, as they figure out which SAT subject test they're going to take, does it matter what areas it's in? Like if they choose to do them all in the humanities versus doing any in the STEM, does that have an impact?
Sure. So first, quick definition. SAT subject tests are the hour-long exams that the College Board offers in a variety of subjects. They are required by some institutions. The majority of those that require are ones that only require if you're an SAT submitter. If you're an ACT submitter, there is only a very small number of schools that actually require subject tests. So quick piece on there. Counter that versus the AP exam, there are 0 domestic institutions that require any AP exam results, and as we are not an AP school, there will be no expectations that they have any AP exam results. International universities absolutely would utilize the AP results in their evaluation of applications. So that would be a time that we would advise students to consider those AP exams. Otherwise, they actually are unnecessary from the point of college admissions. AP exams, when you have them sent to the institution, they go directly to the registrar, not to the admission office, because they are there for college credit, class credit, or advanced standing. So when we think about those, if the student is not considering an international university, we absolutely would prioritize subject tests over AP exams any day of the week. I forgot the second question.
Oh, in terms of the balance of subject tests, like how do they decide which subject test to take, and does it matter if it's all in one area, or do they need to distribute it over multiple areas?
Yeah, for the schools that require subject tests, some have very clear instructions for what they're looking for. They might say, one must be a natural science, or math 2 plus a science. I think of Harvey Mudd and Caltech for ones that have that kind of requirement. But if it's just a general, we want you to have 2 exams, I advise the ones that you can produce the strongest results. Usually it is the ones that you're most interested in and the field that you're looking to go into, so that usually goes hand in hand. Nearly all of our students that take subject tests will consider the Math 2 exam. They're generally ready for that after pre-calculus.
And just to add on to that, because I feel like there's always a little bit of an elephant in the room about subject tests, one of the things I hope you've all had a chance to meet or at least hear our new upper school director, Felicia Wilkes, who is wonderful and awesome. One of the challenges for our students the past couple of years at Lakeside has been, as we as a faculty have redesigned our curriculum to really prepare students for the 21st century, we've drifted in some subjects away from being completely content-based Which these tests are merely, in most cases, testing students' knowledge of content, not always their skills. And so the consequence for that has been that in many cases our students have the stress of coming to Lakeside, which, well, not the stress, I hope that's rewarding for them, but you know, they have work when they come to Lakeside and studying they have to do, and then on top of that they're often finding they're preparing independently for subject tests. Felicia is very committed to finding a way for us to do both as an institution, for preparing, having a curriculum that prepares students for the 21st century and making sure our students are adequately prepared for subject tests. And it is something, it's a conversation that's beginning at the upper school department heads later this month. Hopefully there will be more, we'll have more to share about how to prepare your students for subject tests moving later into the year. But that, I know, has been a concern for many families that we've heard. And it's really, Felicia has all types of ideas about how to get the faculty to work together to work through these issues. Yes?
Given the increased odds for early decision, early action, is there any left good reason not to go through that process? And then what percentage of students
Yep. The question is, giving the odds, the increased odds of early decision and often even early action, is there a reason not to go through with it, and what percent typically do go through with it? So a lot of different numbers here, and I actually do know these numbers. So in a given year, in last year's class, and this is pretty standard, 93% of our students apply either early decision or early action someplace. Now, again, that includes sometimes like places like Santa Clara and places like Tulane have open, non-binding early action. But what that does mean is the vast majority of our students are submitting at least one application between November 1 and November 15th. Last year's class, I think 51% applied binding early decision to an institution. Last year's class, around a third of them were admitted. But every year is different. 2 years ago, two-thirds of them were admitted. So it depends on the class. It depends on what their choices are. It depends on what type of risks they're willing to take. There are two other categories of early action. Colleges wonder why students and families are confused. And I'm like, well, duh. I mean, I can't even remember what they all are without talking them out loud. Harvard, Princeton, Yale, and Stanford have a different early action process called restrictive early action, which is early action, so it's non-binding, but they have one additional rule, which is your student can apply only to that one institution early action. So in normal early action, your student can pair Tulane and Santa Clara and Chapman, and they can do as many early action schools as they want. In restrictive early action, it's one early action school, and the only other early action schools they're allowed to do are public universities in-state and out-of-state. In last year's class, we had around 21% of students apply restrictive early actions. That means they applied to one of those four institutions. As Tiffany was talking about earlier, we support students no matter what they want to do. We help them explain the odds and help them figure out what the opportunity cost is. But sometimes you hear a lot about, okay, like, why was there so much bad news, especially in early? It's because you'll have a class where students took more risks than others. A couple of years ago, it was around 12 or 13% of the class that applied restrictive early action, and there was a lot more better news there because they weren't taking this that same number of risks. Why would you not do it? So I guess a few different reasons. Sometimes there are legitimately scenarios where students just emotionally aren't there yet. And sometimes I would say it depends on their list too. So sometimes we have a student that's like, you want to know what, like, yeah, maybe Pomona, I'm just being hypothetical here, is near my top choice. But honestly, like, I like all the schools on my list. And these three schools that are my likely schools, meaning, you know, we describe likely schools as sort of like your student has a 9 out of 10 chance of being admitted. I really like these likely schools. And honestly, like, I could be thrilled going to them. And if these are my only options, I'd be ecstatic. And in that case, I don't actually really need to apply early decision. Are there scenarios?
When it's not a good reason, right? If they don't have a strong junior year,
yes.
That's typically not a good indicator that ED is the right choice, and that's because the college is going to defer, that they're going to want to see semester grades, and so putting that ED application in is not going to pan out well in that instance. So if students aren't certain that they could have a good experience at that school, and a lot of times they just, sometimes students haven't done enough research to know these things at that point, and they're all kind of on their own little timelines with how where they are in this process. And like Ari said, some of them, you know, come in and they know absolutely what that school is going to be, and others are just kind of like, well, I don't know, like they all kind of seem good and I don't really know what I want. And for those kids, you know, I think they feel pressure to kind of pick one and do it. There are certainly, and I think especially you might hear amongst the chatter of the senior class, I think they certainly put a lot of pressure on themselves, like, I need to pick an ED school, like, I don't know what I want, but, like, I got to choose one. And they don't have to, but they feel like they need to.
Yeah.
So if they don't know they can have a good experience, if they didn't have a strong junior year, if you need to compare financial aid offers, that is a big one, because if you're applying early decision, you're saying, hey, as long as you give me a package that works, like, I'm not interested in anybody else, and I'm coming. Whereas if you're in regular decision, you're going to get different financial aid awards from different schools, and they're not all going to be the same. And in some cases, there could be significant differences between them. And so not applying early decision gives you that opportunity to compare financial aid offers. So if that is going to be a concern for your family, early decision probably is not the right way to go. But we would absolutely want to have that conversation with the student. And then, was there another, I'm trying to think of that.
Testing's not complete.
Oh, right, if you haven't completed testing by this time. So sometimes students are still doing testing in November, they might be needing to do testing in December, and in that case, that's not going to work with that ED timeline. So they really need to be on top of things from the get-go in order to be prepared to apply ED in November.
I'd say we spend a lot of time with students, I think we all have this, helping them try to figure out, are they ready to make a decision, or are they just scared to make a decision?
Yeah.
And there's a difference. So a lot of times kids come in and they've done, as Tiffany said, they've done their research. Like, there's nothing more they need to do or can do, but they're torn between two schools, and their solution is, oh, I can't apply early decision. And so our response will often be, if you got into both schools in the spring, are you going to be in, like, if you wait, are you going to have additional clarity, or are you going to be in the same boat in the spring? And I'd say 80% of the case, their answer is, I'll be in the same boat in the spring. And then, so my predecessor twice removed, Bruce Bailey, called that deferred decision making. Like, defer the decision, hope maybe one college admits you and the other doesn't, so they make the decision for you. Then you don't have to make a really tough choice. But to the question about odds, it could also mean, too, if you're not willing to sort of think through how to make the choice, that you lose both options. So we can do two more questions. I see three more hands. We'll do three more.
I just have a kind of a global question, since most people here are just starting out on this process. And just, if could you just frame for parents what you've seen, you know, through all of your vast experience, what works really well for families going forward and how they can support their kids through the process versus what you've seen maybe a few pitfalls of parents or families doing where they think they're being helpful and maybe not so much, so that we can start this process with our children, you know, the best way possible.
Yep. Great question. Essentially, the question is, how can families, what can you do as parents and guardians to best support your kids in the process and ensure that they get off to a good start and that the entire process goes really well? I mean, there are lots of things. I guess what I would say, letting your student take the lead in this. There are lots of analogies we use. We use the car analogy sometimes. You know, your student is in the driver's seat. We are in the passenger seat with them. You are in the car, but you're in the back seat.
Trunk.
Actually, sometimes I had one student basically make the analogy, back seat's okay, but mom, if you don't calm down, you're going in the trunk. We're all on a team together. Student, you're the captain. We're the coach. Parents and guardians, you're on the team, but you're not the coach and you're not the captain. So we use those types of analogies too. And the flip side too, we always do tell the students, we want to treat you like adults and this is your process, but we also need you to act like adults. So if you stop, if you're being irresponsible, if you're missing deadlines, and I'm not talking about once or twice here and there, but if you're coming to meetings repeatedly and you're not doing anything, and we're now worried about your process, we are going to reach out to your parents and guardians at that point and ask for your help. And they're probably going to have that conversation at home, and you're probably going to get really annoyed and unhappy. And the dinner table that night is probably going to be a big mess. But you can avoid that if you stay on top of that, and if you fall behind, let us know, and we can help you catch back up. So we always tell them we want to treat them like parent, like adults, but if they fall behind, we do reach out to you and ask for your help and let them know that that they're behind. I'd say the other thing that, we live in a society that's very, I don't know if it's for better or worse, we live in a society that's very brand name focused, and it's not only with colleges; it's everything. You know, I tell my students sometimes when they're like, gosh, I feel like I need to go to a brand name school. I'm like, you know, that's the messaging we get in every segment of society about the importance of brand name is that brand name matters. Even though in 90% of the cases, studies show no matter what sector it is, the brand name doesn't matter. But the message is that it does. You know, I always tell my students, like, I'm sort of obsessed. I know Sam knows where I'm going with this. I'm sort of obsessed with facial products. And I know... I know in my brain that if I go to the Rite Aid, I literally live across the street from a Rite Aid. Like, if I go to Rite Aid and buy the cheapest facial products, my skin is either going to look just as good or just as bad when I'm 70 than if I go to Sephora and buy facial products. Yet there is a piece of me that still says I need to go to Sephora. And I cannot explain it. Like, but that's the power of marketing. And so I guess what I think is really healthy for all of us is if parents and guardians can begin to step back in this process on their own and realize what are the messages they've heard about college, about what's brand, what's good, what's not good, and try to acknowledge those and keep those in check, because there will be some students that will go to what you might perceive as a brand name institution, but your student might not go to one of them, or they might not want to go to one of them. And so be for you to be able to process that sooner, so you can come into the process ready to be like, okay, maybe it's brand name, maybe it's not brand name, but it's going to be okay. And that's a really, really good place, a really good thing to do beforehand. Because I think when that doesn't happen, even when parents are really trying to be supportive, sometimes what happens in meetings is, you know, you're saying as a parent, we really want Johnny to be happy. We're totally behind them. We don't care if it's brand name. But can he get into Harvard? And so even though you really are trying, the message they just heard with that, you know, in that scenario was, actually, mom or dad would really be much happier or prouder of me if I went to Harvard. So if that's just something you can begin to sift through ahead of time. And again, I think it's just the world we live in. For some of us, it's cars. For some of us, it's facial products. For some of us, it's colleges. But the more we can begin to process that and get through that ahead of time, I think the smoother it is for the students.
And so this year we asked the seniors in their summer survey to tell us what they wish they could tell their parents about this process without any repercussions. And so I just want to read a couple of things. First, the thank you. So you see, this is what's good. Thank you for not making me apply to schools that I don't like and not being super concerned about the prestige of a school and focusing more on whether it would be a good fit for me. So that's good general. There were a lot less thank yous than there were requests to stop doing things. I wish you didn't apply so much pressure or seem so disappointed in my backup schools, comparing them to what some of my friends or other students have done or where they have gotten into. Stop comparing me, my application, my writing, my test scores, my grades with other students who you know personally, whose parents you're friends with, or who you have read about on the internet. I wish not every conversation turned into a conversation about the college process. I promise I think about it enough on my own. I wish my parents were more open with taking a look at and researching colleges that weren't just in the top 20 list. I wish you would let me go wherever I want, regardless of reputation or prestige. I wish you would understand that one college is never so simply better than another just because of the lower acceptance rate or Ivy status. I wish you would understand that the best college or university for me might not top US News or Forbes lists. I wish you'd put less weight into what your friends say about the college process. Of course, I respect your opinions, but I also wish you'd respect mine a little more and the decisions I make. So just have these on top of mind, yeah.
And one of the comments Tiffany read, I think, is especially powerful to your question. You know, it's in our culture, and I, both at Lakeside and say in general, for, in some odd way, the college admission process has become this like public discourse. You know, your student is at like Thanksgiving with relatives. Where are you applying to college? What are your SAT scores? What are your grades? What are your GPA? And it's a constant for them. But it's interesting because when you think about other things in life that are somewhat comparable, like when you apply for jobs, like you never ask someone like, oh, when you, you know, what are the jobs that you apply for? Who, did you get a job offer? How much money were you offered? You know, oh, who where did you interview and not get selected? You know, there, but so, and to, and I guess for us, the college process is sort of that way. It's a private process where students should be able to disclose whatever they choose to disclose and not disclose what they don't want to. But we live in a culture where somehow it's become very public. I'm always surprised when I go on college tours and there'll be a parent that asks the tour guide, what were your SAT scores? And I'm sort of like, that's none of your business. Like, and the tour guides usually handle it pretty well. But, you know, or, you know, I'll never ask a student on a tour, like, what are the schools that you apply to? Now, I'll often say to them, how did you choose to come to school X? And I'd say in half the cases that involves their choosing to say, oh, I looked at these schools and I chose. But in some cases, they don't want to. So just be really sort of trying to get into the mindset that this is not a public discourse, I think, makes it a lot better for students. So we have two more questions. I know, Terry, you had one, and then in the back, and then we're going to wrap up. The question is, when you look at the GPAs on scattergrams, do they include all the high school classes or do they admit PE and art? And they do omit PE and art. So it's just English, math, social studies, science, and languages.
And the reason for that,
yes,
though, is because when if colleges are going to recalculate GPAs, or even when they're if they don't recalculate, but they're just looking at a transcript, they're not going to pay attention to PE and art. So we're trying to make it as real as we can.
And I can't remember... Sam, maybe you said this, and so I'm sorry if I'm being repetitive, but in case we didn't. The GPA that your student is going to get right before Thanksgiving is really only an internal GPA that, for the sake of their being able to use Naviance and some of the data and see where they fit in with the data. They're on the transcript or in the materials we send out, there is no GPA that we share with colleges. So we try to get the students to think more about what are the grades, what is the trend of grades. The reason for that is because a GPA is one quick number. There, a 3.5 can be many different things. A student who has a 3.5 could be a consistent B+ and A- student throughout high school. A student who has a 3.5 could be a student that was a B student throughout freshman and sophomore year and just woke up and became an A student in junior year. A B student could be a student that was an A student in freshman and sophomore year and decided that junior wasn't that important, they didn't care, and they suddenly became a BC student. And so the GPA is it's a quick snapshot, but for colleges, they're really interested in what is the trend, what is the story. Good question. If the student applies early decision, there are three different options. So I'm going to elaborate on the question just for folks that might not know. There are three different decisions they can receive as an early decision or early action notification process. The first, obviously, which is what they want, is an admit. The opposite extreme, of course, is deny. And the third, the middle ground, is they can be what's called deferred to the regular pool, meaning the college says, we're not going to finalize the decision now on your application. We're going to, and it's automatic, we're automatically going to bump you to the regular pool and reconsider you with the larger pool of applicants. There is usually, they don't have to reapply. It happens automatically. In most cases, there's nothing additional they have to do, although we encourage them in February to write a letter with any updates and reaffirming their interest. And a select number of cases, and this could be one thing if you can just, I know sometimes they push back on your feedback and help, but gently nudge them about the importance of reading instructions thoroughly. There are a select number of institutions like a Santa Clara where if you're deferred in the early action pool, you have to just press confirm that you do want to stay active in the regular pool. And every year we have a few students, no matter how many times we say that, they get the notice in like February from Santa Clara, we've now withdrawn your application because you haven't, and they're like, ah, I didn't know. And I'm like, didn't you read the deferral letter? No. And I'm like, you need to read the entire thing. And so just, and I know they have lots going on in their plate, but they're quick to want to look at the, you know, what's the quick little thing they need to do and move on. But sometimes there can be something really important embedded in the notifications that come from colleges.
And if they're denied, they can reapply.
No, if they're denied, they cannot reapply in the regular pool. They can only submit one application per admission cycle. So they can certainly reapply the following year, but not in that same, not during that same academic year. That's a great question, and the question is what can, in the culture of Lakeside, where there's so much, some of our students hit the ground running in ninth grade thinking about, okay, this is about getting into Harvard, and I need to sort of make every decision along those lines, what can we do? The answer I always give, and we spend a lot of time with the students, and this is actually where we can, if we can partner, this would be great. We really spend a lot of time with students trying to get them to really think carefully about how they talk about colleges with their classmates, and I think that's actually one of the pieces that becomes really, really, really hard for our students. The comments such as, you want to go to school X? That's not a Lakeside school. You want to go to, why would you want to go to school Y? That's such a safety school. You know, why would you work so hard only to go to that type of university? So really getting to think about, like, you know, as I told the seniors recently, there are lots of great schools out there, and my motto is, just because if you use the standard of, if you know it, it's a good school, well, keep in mind, they probably haven't heard of you. So if that's the standard, then you're not anything very good. And so to really think about what that is. But yes, we would spend a lot of time talking about, like, think before you speak, think about what assumptions you're making, and think about the impact of somebody else. We have students every year who feel like they have a good college list, and something along the lines happens of, you know, student X is dreaming of going to Lehigh, and someone in their class says something along the lines of, why would anyone apply to Lehigh? That's such a safety school. And of course, the student is in tears, you know, feeling like, wow, I thought I was doing this process well, and am I a failure? Am I a disappointment? So we really spend time on that. And if you also, when you, in your homes and when they have friends over, if you hear some of that, if you can also chime in, just to sort of get them that mentality of, like, we need to think inclusively about colleges, be open-minded, and be supportive of each other.
But I think that's an ongoing concern. I've gone to some admissions conferences and attended sessions on how to decrease stress around the process. And so this is something that that is a pressure cooker for independent schools like us. And it's something I know Bernie is concerned about and wants to address. And we're absolutely on board with whatever ways there can be for us to all work together to really bring the pressure and the stress and anxiety around this process down.
Well, we do need to wrap up. One quick thing before we do. We're already late for 9:45, but that's okay. One quick thing. We would ask if you either, so this link on the board here, this is the link, Tiffany, right?
Yeah.
Tinyurl.com/those letters. If you could either, it's really short, either right now on your phones, or if you wouldn't mind writing that down, it is the shortest of surveys that we ask that you complete just to give us some feedback on the coffee. It's literally four quick questions. You can do it in a minute or shorter, but we're always curious to know, was it helpful? And then were there other topics that you were hoping to learn more about or hear about that weren't covered? So in future years when we do this again, we can think about how to improve it. So again, if you do it now, awesome. Or otherwise, if you can do it later this evening, that would be wonderful. Thank you so much. On the sheet here and then on the website, it has some of the upcoming programs that are specific for juniors and families. So if you're applying for financial aid, we hope to see you at our financial aid programs. Otherwise, we will see all of you at one of the December programs, which will be a much more thorough presentation of data and actually introducing the process and the trends. So thank you.